Welcome to the Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. Nice to be with you. I am Mark Pettis and with my friend, colleague, John Bagnulo. John, good morning, my friend.
Hey, good morning, Mark, and happy September.
Happy September. We are getting closer to the autumn equinox, and this is a very beautiful time of year where we live, and that fall feeling is in the air. All the kids are back at school. I see the school buses out on the street now, and all the high school student athletes are out, you know, raising money. And it's part of that cycle, right? That rhythm of the calendar year. It feels different as September rolls around, and so we're
in that transition
now, and it's an exciting time. And we are looking at some research today, John, based on a recently published paper, very recent, that is examining the pervasive presence of mold mycotoxin, mold and fungal mycotoxin, in many plant-based foods. And in particular, this paper looked at foods that are central to this propagation of meat substitutes, dairy substitutes. And so this research looked at many, I think it was over 35, 36 products commercially available in that market, and did a very detailed analysis of the presence of mold and fungal mycotoxin in these food products. And the results, as we will share, are pretty eye-opening, John, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm really that surprised, outside of the fact that it was 100% of the samples tested positive. I think that, to me, was probably the most surprising. I wouldn't be surprised to see like 40, 50%, but to see that 100% contained mycotoxins at significant levels, and then a large percentage had multiple mycotoxins present. It wouldn't just be ochratoxin A, or be, you know, several. And I think that's the part that's like, wow, like this is a public health issue.
Very much so. So we will look at this paper specifically, what it found, why mycotoxins are indeed very important to at least be aware of, as they are pervasive in our environments. And we'll look at some of the other supporting research that is quite clear that higher body burdens of mycotoxin, the mycotoxin load, if you will, can very significantly contribute to disrupted metabolic health, a central theme in our podcast discussions, lipid metabolism, gut biome, and leaky gut or gut barrier function, all of the many sort of metabolic acupressure points that we know drive chronic complex disease and can profoundly disrupt quality of life. Can be connected to the presence of mycotoxins. And then we'll focus, John, a little bit on sort of the pragmatic. You know, how can one translate this in a way that might influence food choice, preparation, how they care for themselves? Because like all these modern environmental challenges, they're almost impossible to avoid exposure to. So the incentive for the human, right, navigating this modern life is, how can I, with that knowledge, adapt my environment, my lifestyle, my choices, ultimately in a way that can at least allow me to mitigate the extent to which that is a problem. And so I think this is a topic that will open some eyes, if they're not already open, with respect to this.
Yeah, and I think it should make, you know, for those who are interested, I think it should lead to the question, you know, what are the real upsides of these meat analogs, these dairy substitutes? You know, and you know, if someone is avoiding it for allergy purposes, which is, I think, is almost never the case with red meat. Most people don't have allergies to red meat, but I can understand if someone's looking for an alternative to milk because they have a dairy allergy. But if you're, you know, if a person is choosing a meat alternative for health reasons, I think when you start to look at the downsides and some of the negative qualities of all of these meat alternatives, you know, it really begs the question, you know, what are the upsides to these other than maybe convenience and maybe cost? I don't know. But this is like the tip of the iceberg for me, Mark. I mean, you know, these mycotoxins are a real health issue, but they're not the only substance in meat alternatives that would really give me pause to having any of them. I mean, you know, you have the glyphosate content because almost all of these are made with one type of legume or another. And we know that legumes are the most, you know, for the most part, they're the most contaminated category of crop grown that is going to receive the largest amounts of glyphosate. So you have that, you have the omega-6 content of a lot of these that are based on, you know, sunflower seed meal, soybean meal, some other type of legume meal. And and then often they include oils, seed oils that, you know, are not going to really be favorable with respect to their omega-6 content. So the list goes on and on, but again, everybody has heard this, just eat plants, and they've, you know, I think people have kind of bought into that without really questioning what's the science behind this, because as you and I try to expose every time we cover the topic, there, you know, there are a lot of misconceptions about red meat. It doesn't have the adverse effect on health. If anything, it's protective. But, you know, it's this is just another example of that.
Yeah, well, there are so many layers to this discussion, John, and yeah, I appreciate your broadening this context. Mycotoxins are, you know, one of many representatives around this growing market for engineered foods and condemnation of foods that have resulted in this sort of market incentive to be producing things that are really entirely new to nature and things that exist out there today that tend to get the halo because they're plants. And when you start to look at the environments within which the plants are grown and all that comes with that, you realize that at the end of the day, what you're putting into your system isn't nearly as angelic and health promoting as the public health messaging would suggest. So I'll just bring up these slides, John, and we'll look at this study. So this very recently published a couple months ago in a journal called Mycotoxin Research. And again, the title is Mycotoxin Occurrence and Risk Assessment in Plant-Based Meat, Cheese, and Fish Alternatives. And for the chemistry laboratory geeks, you know, they use very state-of-the-art liquid chromatography and spectroscopy to identify with great precision a whole host of mycotoxins, and so very rigorous methodology. So they measured 15 mycotoxins in a variety, 32 commercial plant-based meats and cheeses. 27 out of the 32 products contained at least one of the target mycotoxins. And the seitan-based products, right, these wheat-based, very
gluten. Right? I mean, seitan is straight gluten. I mean, that's pure gluten.
Yeah.
That's how seitan is produced. They wash away all but the gluten content of wheat.
It's amazing. And they had the highest level of contamination. And as we often reflect on, John, from a environmental protection, sort of FDA, there is a tendency to look at lower levels of circulating toxins as not sort of clinically significant. And yet we know from so much of the research that virtually all of the levels detected here were sufficient enough to disrupt human health, even though many of the concentrations through the eyes of a regulator would be less attention getting, right? So I think that's just an important public health message, yeah. You know, in the same way that there's no safe level of mercury, you can have a mercury level that's considered to be significantly low enough to, you know, not be concerned about health. And that, you know, I think our listeners appreciate that that's a very flawed perceptual landscape to be looking at this from. So these plant-based alternatives are not specifically included in relevant food safety regulations. So they're really not on the radar in a way that one might expect or hope for. And this is just a brief review, a quantitative analysis of the mycotoxin content in these alternative meat and dairy products revealed that, you know, the contamination was universal and pronounced. And this alternaria, there are many toxins. We'll look briefly at some of these categories, were present across all product groups. As you said, 100% of these products tested had some contamination of something. The Aspergillus toxins were a bit more sporadic. Fusarium, I know these names aren't going to mean much, but this was very highly concentrated in these wheat-based seitan products. And 29 out of 32 products showed contamination with at least one mycotoxin. And the seitan products were particularly affected by multiple identifiable toxins. So, and as you point out, John, and this is just a conclusion from the paper, from the authors. However, this is only part of the real situation. To assess the safety of plant-based alternatives in general, additional aspects such as pesticide residues, as you pointed out, John, glyphosate as an herbicide, heavy metal contamination, other contaminants, the nutritional composition of the products would need to be looked at in a much broader way. So this, as you point out, John, is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And this is, these are just a few groups of many categories of mycotoxins. And I think some people are familiar with aflatoxins. That's been one of the more widely studied. And again, this is produced by Aspergillus mold, very common in peanuts, corn, tree nuts, rice. And we know that this is hepatotoxic. It increases the risk of liver cancer. We'll look at a review looking at cancer risk from these mycotoxins, okra toxins. And I'm just sort of putting these out there, John. I know you've got a lot of insight. And again, from Aspergillus and penicillium molds and in grains, coffees, dried fruits, you see higher concentrations of these mycotoxins. And they're well known to affect immune function, kidney damage, the fumonisins, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, yeah. Fusarium mold, that too found in many of these products. And again, you will often find this in maize, corn-based products. Significant effects on GI, nervous system. And again, this is just, these are like the top five or six major groups of mycotoxins, the trichothecines, produced by Fusarium mold and wheat, barley, oats. You do tend to see these patterns, right, John? The cereal grains, grains in general. And again, these others you can see very common, and you find them in apples, pears. And again, many of these have hormonal disruptive effects. And so you have this host and pervasive presence in commonly consumed foods, foods that are often advised because they are felt to be healthier than many of the animal-based food alternatives. And we know mechanistically that these just have many, many, many areas of clinical disruption and health disruption. And I'll just pause there for a minute, John, because I know you've got.
Yeah, I mean, share. No, hey, that's great. Those two slides on the more common types of molds and the mycotoxins that they produce. Those are, I think, really important because it shows what a like broad spectrum of foods these molds are found in. And the one thing I think could be helpful here is that when you look through the literature, for instance, on fusarium or on zearalenone, which is found in the corn and wheat, when you look at a couple of those mycotoxins, you know, this really speaks to something you just mentioned earlier about kind of FDA allowances for these in the food supply, what we consider to be a safe level, whether that's in a food, dietary exposure, or in a person's body. What's not appreciated is that the quantity of some of these foods that populations eat is massive. Like when you get into wheat and corn, there are populations, and I'm not talking about other places in the world, I'm talking about here in the United States, where people are having a breakfast cereal every morning, they're having some type of wheat or corn type product for their other two meals, they may be having a meat alternative, a dairy alternative. So, you know, the absolute quantity of some of these sources of mycotoxins, it's throughout the day. It's at every meal. You know, and sometimes I hear, you know, about the research on foods that we'll talk about, whether it's peanut butter or it's balsamic vinegar or it's chocolate. And some of these foods get the headlines because they have really high amounts. But in comparison, the amount of balsamic vinegar that someone consumes over the course of a year, it's nothing, right? Compared to the amount of wheat or corn or some type of legume that can be really high in mycotoxins that people are eating every day. I mean, look how much the amount of soybean meal that gets woven into so many different foods on the average American plate, it's massive, right? And that soybean meal is a source for mycotoxins, glyphosate. I mean, the list goes on and on. So I think it's important to look at things like on a like quantitative perspective. And that's what's great about those slides. When you start looking at the sources of some of those mycotoxins, they're foods that people eat as staples, Mark. Staples, right? 25, 30% of their calories coming from some of these things. So I think that's what really puts it into perspective here is that we're not talking about at the end of the day, someone being exposed to these trace amounts of mycotoxins, and we're just alarmists kind of calling out the amount of aflatoxin or ochratoxin A that's in someone's breakfast cereal or that's in the, you know, the corn products that someone's eating. You know, we're talking about large amounts of exposure because of how much of these foods people eat. That's the one thing I wanted to add to it, is that you've got like, I think you have some very misleading allowances with respect to what can be, you know, what's considered safe in a food. I just think people don't really understand the magnitude of exposure that you get when you're eating you're drinking a dairy alternative, you're drinking a soy milk, or you're drinking an oat milk, and you're drinking it every day, or you're putting it in your cereal every day. Now you're putting it on top of a wheat or a corn-based cereal. You end up with a pretty good burden, right? Mycotoxin burden at the end of the day, given the amount of those foods that are part of your diet.
Yeah, that's beautiful, John. And we know that these toxins, whether we're talking mycotoxins or other environmental toxins, these persistent organic pollutants, and that they are very lipophilic. They get stored in fat, and we have a public health crisis of obesity, and so people can store large amounts of these. The body burden,
as
fat stores goes up, is, you know, even greater because you have so much storage capacity, and so over one's lifetime, you have this perpetual presence of toxins, and so not only are they right getting a lot, but these toxins perpetuate obesity and poor metabolic health. And it's that those increases in fat stores that allow you to hold even more, a higher burden of these toxins. And it is sort of the perfect storm.
Think about it on this level, and I know you do, Mark, but for our listeners' sake, so if you take into account this added burden on the body, on top of the glycemic load that a lot of these foods present, on the way that they can disrupt the microbiome because of their carbohydrate density, when you start to stack it up, it's, to your point, it is a perfect storm. As if the effort for the body to maintain some sort of glycemic control, as if that isn't enough.
Yeah.
Now you're going to throw something into the mix, right, that's going to promote fatty liver disease, that's going to really reduce or create a bottleneck with respect to detoxification in the liver. And it's death by a thousand cuts. This is a pretty big cut, right? This is a pretty big cut. I mean, you're talking about bleeding out from two or three of these attributes that a lot of these foods have. And Mark, I'm not sure if you're going to get to it, but thank you for sharing the paper that you just covered. Were you going to cover the paper? I forget. It was a May of 2026 paper. It was a UK study where they looked at 212 different foods.
I think that is in this slide deck, John.
Gotcha. Okay.
I wasn't sure. Yeah. If so, we'll see it in a minute. If not, we'll.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah. Sorry.
No, not at all. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. In my review of this topic, I was pleased to see a couple of really nice reviews over the last 12 months, very current. We know this is just the tip of the iceberg of many mechanisms that mycotoxins are associated with, from cellular and DNA damage. We know that these are sources of oxidative stress. They alter DNA transcription and alter the function of cellular proteins. And so, that alone is attention getting. And then when you add the effects on our immune systems.
Mark, I'm sorry to interrupt here, but real quick, let me just share one thing on this immune suppression that I find fascinating. When I first started looking at, patients or clients' blood work, 25, 30 years ago, I was always amazed at how so many individuals, when they went to a almost entirely plant-based diet, that their white blood cell count started getting down into low normal or below normal, mild leukopenia, right? Started getting down into the high threes, 3.8, that type of range. And, at that time, and I don't know if some of this might be still part of the mix here, the milieu of this storm, but at that time, my reasoning, this is 25 years ago, was that, was the lectin load, the amount of lectins in chickpeas and things like that, which do have the ability to cause abnormalities in white blood cell populations. Some of these are, again, they cause like an agglutination type of reaction in the blood. But, as each year passes and we consider the effects of mycotoxins on the white blood cell population and on the effectiveness of white blood cells, as I look back, I think about this, this kind of more typical plant-based leukopenia syndrome, I think a lot of it has to do with the mycotoxin content as much or more than lectins. So when you talk about immune suppression, that's a real thing. That's a real issue with this, the exposure that a lot of people are getting.
Yeah, I believe this is a very common and under-recognized association, John. I've seen a lot of people through the years with a low white blood count and otherwise no apparent reason for that.
Right.
And,
right.
We talked last week about zinc. We know many of these plant-based foods will through their phytate concentrations, right? It's part of this broader stacking. Will lower zinc absorption. And we know that probably certain viral, low level, maybe even subclinical viral impact for people with these low white blood cell counts is often triggered by these mycotoxins. And And we know, you know, from other research, organ toxicity, certainly, you know, the kidneys tend to concentrate a lot of what circulates. And so the renal tissue will tend to have higher concentrations by virtue of how they function. We've talked about hepato liver toxicity, endocrine disruption. I mean, this is a very broad topic, and there are so many new to nature toxins that we know will disrupt the endocrine system. But, you know, for the individual, for the clinician, for the registered dietitian, these things might appear as polycystic ovarian syndrome, insulin resistance, right? Visceral fat, you know, so you see how the phenotype has really become so prominent in the public health of you know, people across the age continuum. And I think this whole issue of endocrine disruption, we've yet to see the full scope of how young adults, and right, whether you're talking about sperm counts in males and ovulatory disruption in women and infertility challenges, there's something's happening in our environment, and we are, you know, we are the canaries in the coal mine. 21st century humans are in a coal mine that is unlike any that generations before us have inhabited, you know. So you see all these things out there in the clinical world that, you know, leave researchers, clinicians scratching their heads. And yet really, the more you dig, the more you see that a lot of this can be explained by what's pervasive in the environments that we now live in. And then gastrointestinal disruption, right? Gut lining. And our listeners know the gut is central to every aspect of total body health. And we'll look at a paper in a moment that points to the disruption of these mycotoxins on the gut biome and gut barrier function. And once that system is disrupted, you know, it all bets are off on you know, the ease with which one can maintain their health.
Yeah.
This is a paper, John, that I think you had brought to my attention.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Really important, looking at mycotoxins in lipids. And this, too, is a very recent systematic review, 2026 this year, and in July, Frontiers in Toxicology. And the what I wanted to just briefly point out, John, and then I'll let you comment. These were two of the laboratory findings that were pretty pervasive. Now, these were animal studies, so this is preclinical. And in these two examples, you're looking at triglyceride levels in relationship to higher exposure to mycotoxin versus control. And in this top panel, these are triglyceride levels. You can see pretty much across the board, and these are all separate studies. So this was a systematic review. In almost every study in this review, triglyceride levels went up considerably relative to control animals, both avian and rodent. And then in the lower panel, again, the blue being the mycotoxin and this sort of beige color being the control group, you can see in many of these studies, HDL levels much lower. So we frequently talk about, John, the importance of a high triglyceride HDL ratio in a standard lipid panel as being perhaps one of the most important aspects of a standard lipid panel, and its predictive value for insulin resistance and all that comes with disrupted metabolic health. So this, I thought, was a nice example of how lipids specifically in that way I'm sure if we measured insulin levels here, John, in these rodents, we would have seen higher insulin levels in the mycotoxin group versus control, blood pressure, et cetera. And so I thought this was really fascinating.
Yeah, and we know, Mark, that that particular profile, higher triglycerides, lower HDL levels in any species, is indicative of a growing number or presence of fatty liver deposits. So, you know, this might be like the initial stages as the liver, because as you mentioned, these mycotoxins are very lipophilic, right? They prefer to be in more of a fat-based medium. So, you know, there's a theory, and I wouldn't say it's been fully, you know, proven, elucidated more, but it's that because there's sort of an urgency to get these toxins bound, somewhat, you know, like captured or compartmentalized, like they just start, you know, they just start kind of like becoming entrapped in these fat molecules. And if you can't get rid of them, you got to do something to keep them a little bit more separated or segregated from the rest of the body. So there's definitely a role there with respect to liver metabolism and it being triage with respect to getting these toxins into some shape or form that they're not going to be, you know, it's not going to become more damaging than they already are on the immediate basis. So, you know, there's something going on there, but I was, again, in the mid 1990s, I was involved with in a graduate program I was in, I was involved in a study with chickens where we took the livers from 50 chickens that had known aflatoxin exposure. And we took the livers from 50 chickens that did not have any aflatoxins in their feed supply. And it was really clear when you looked at the livers of the chickens with the aflatoxins, you could see the white fatty streaks or deposits present in those livers. And their blood was very different in terms of what we found there in the way of lipids. So, And this was in the mid-1990s, but that was specific to aflatoxin. We weren't looking at some of the other mycotoxins. So, you know, I think, you know, what's really interesting about this topic is that we're trying to highlight the presence of these in what a lot of people consider to be a healthy alternative to some sort of animal protein, right? But, you know, farmers have known for decades, if not more, that mold in the feed in the feed source for any of the animals that you're trying to grow is going to be really counterproductive to that animal's health. So I find that really interesting, as you know, you and I often reflect on what we have known to be true for decades or centuries sometimes requires, you know, something like this for us to apply it to the human population, right? It's really interesting that, you know, farmers have known, you know, if you want to continue to breed your blue ribbon cow, you probably don't want to give that cow mold contaminated grain. Yet humans need, you know, we need about 4 or 5 clinically controlled double-blind placebo studies for us to say, wow, it's probably best if a young couple who want to have children at some point, it's probably best for them to avoid mycotoxins as well. Isn't it fascinating, though, the gap between, like, you know, whatever you want to call it, whether it's agricultural-based learning or farmer's knowledge or whatever we want to call it, I just find it really intriguing that we need a certain body of evidence for us to apply it to the human experience.
Yeah, yeah. Such a great point, John. That, and the extent to which, you know, we are a species with amnesia. We've sort of lost that earth level knowledge so that things today surprise us in ways that our ancestors, even, you know, a couple generations ago, would have said, well, of course.
Exactly.
And didn't require a PhD or randomized controlled trial to draw that conclusion. And there are just so many good examples of that, right, John?
Yeah.
Just a few more papers here. This, again, looking at endocrine effects, and we've talked about the endocrine disruption effects and the metabolic health effects. and this is a 2023 publication in a journal called Toxins, and again, just this is a review of the impact of mycotoxins on gut health and microbiota. And from the graphic here, John, this is just a reminder that these toxins increase the permeability of the gut, and we know that everything begins to shift and more of a pro-inflammatory, chronic inflammatory systemic state, and you see changes in the common species that are measured that are thought to have some health promoting effect. And once you these burdens of mycotoxins increase the lipopolysaccharide, which is a measure of gut barrier function, as LPS goes up in the blood, that is sort of the metabolic equivalent of somebody who's septic. It's not on the extreme where they're in septic shock and you're admitting them to the critical care unit. I see low levels of sort of endotoxemia, as we all know, that really drive all aspects of metabolic health, brain health, cardiovascular health, and here hepatocellular cancer in this example, how more pathogenic bacteria seem to thrive with high mycotoxin load, drops in the beneficial bacteria. And while this particular graphic focuses on liver cancer, as you pointed out earlier, John, we know that this is a major driver of all chronic complex health issues. And this is just a review looking at mycotoxins in food and mechanisms that drive cancer risk. And again, these are very busy graphics, but for those that want to, I'll upload all these. These are all open source reviews on our website. But you can just see the many cellular mechanisms from DNA damage in the example of aflatoxin, oxidative stress with ochratoxin, cell cycle disruption, and the extent to which that interferes with the cell's ability to eliminate itself when an early cancer change emerges. So this is an important protective mechanism for cancer, which gets disrupted. We've talked about immune suppression and alterations in T cell macrophage, this innate immune system, which is a beautifully intelligent system, and the adaptive immune systems with antibody formation are profoundly disrupted. And we know that epigenetic modification, we talk a lot about epigenetics, John, and almost any time an epigenetic lab measures the methylation and histone modification patterns of whatever it is they're studying, you tend to see profound changes. And in this example of ochratoxin, gene expression is very much disrupted. And of course, all of these, right, add up in some way to increase cancer risk. And we would make the case, John, that it increases the risk of other chronic complex diseases, because most, whether you're talking about metabolic health or cardiovascular health or degenerative brain disease or cancer or autoimmunity, they all have these common mechanistic drivers. And so you could be talking about almost any chronic complex disease here with respect to these mechanisms.
Yeah, and the interesting thing here, Mark, is that the damage or the sum of the parts is actually much greater than expected when you combine one of these mycotoxins with a virus like the herpes virus.
Yeah.
You get, Epstein-Barr is the same way. If you put Epstein-Barr virus in the presence of ochratoxin A or aflatoxin, it's the magnitude is much greater.
Yes.
Than one would think.
Absolutely, John. And that's so important, as and maybe a topic worth visiting at some point, is how remote viral exposures, be it, you know, Epstein-Barr, herpes, that these can, they tend to be latent in our yeah. systems for a lifetime. And we, what one sees, particularly with Alzheimer's and other degenerative mm-hmm. neurologic diseases, is often brain evidence of inflammation and what appears to be an immune response to what for some is reactivation yeah. of these otherwise latent viruses. And so when people start to question what would cause that reactivation, you would have to add mycotoxins to that list. And this is just another graphic from this paper mm-hmm. looking at the ZEN or xenobiotics, right? These are just, it's just a word that speaks to foreign substances to human biology. And again, in this instance, from oxidative stress, inflammation, endocrine disruption, you know, metabolic signaling through the mTOR mechanism. We know that all of these critical healing, rejuvenating systems in the body, from autophagy to DNA repair to apoptosis, you know, biogenesis of new mitochondria, all of this becomes disrupted. And so, again, you get that perfect storm. And this is just, I think, the last paper, John, from 2025, again, looking at a review of the pervasive nature of mycotoxins in food and the extent to which, you know, these common food sources, grains, corn, peanuts, coffee, you know, all of these at even very low levels that would be considered, you know, relatively safe, are known to have mechanistic disruption. And so it is kind of the elephant in the room. And I realized, John, as we go through those slides, that I did not have the that other 2026.
No, okay.
So yeah, maybe you could just comment on that. And then we can just close with all this sort of information. How can people, you know,
reverse? How can they reverse the damage?
Look at maybe how they choose in the future, or things that they can do to help them clear these pervasive toxins from their systems.
Yeah, no, the 2026 paper is in the journal. It was May of 2026. It was the journal Food Control, Mycotoxin Contamination in Plant-Based Beverages and Meat Alternatives, a survey of the UK market. So this was a study done in the UK. There were 212 different products tested. I can't tell you how many of those would be available in the US, but 212 that were produced either in Europe or more like a global type of dairy alternative, right? So some big companies producing these. Out of the 212, all 212 tested positive for mycotoxins at what were considered significant levels. So these weren't borderline or questionable. They were present at the threshold that they considered to be a level of confidence that, yes, it was in there at a significant level. But I think more concerning was that 80% had more than one mycotoxin at significant levels. So you're talking about 80% of, you know, 212, you know, 165 samples had multiple mycotoxins with known harmful human effects. And at the end of the day, like you and I, you know, asked the question, you know, why? What are we looking at these foods for as a healthy alternative when they're heavily processed? They contain mycotoxins. The majority, I can almost guarantee, contain glyphosate because of their legume and grain-based content. They all tend to contain some type of industrial seed oil, right? So it's more of an engineered, heavily processed food that, I mean, is the upside the convenience? Is it the cost? I can't really probably get into the economics of it as much as I would like to, but I think that's probably part of it. But I think at the end of the day, Mark, and I'll kind of hear your thoughts on this. For me, it's all marketing. It's all marketing, and it's the words plant-based, that's a very attention-catching phrase, and it has been for the last couple decades, right? And now plant protein, I see that on so many products, right? 20 grams of plant protein. Well, again, that protein needs to be questioned, because a lot of plant proteins, whether it's from the seitan, has low biological value, whether it's the protein that might be contributed, from a lentil burger. Important questions to ask.
Most definitely. And it really does sort of beg for the question is, to what extent are we being misled? I don't necessarily assume that being misled implies vicious intent. No. I think there is still a large gap in sort of global knowledge. People have expertise in their particular silo. Rarely do you hear people that have some familiarity with various disciplines that can step back at a high enough altitude to read the constellation. And so I do think we tend to get so lost in the weeds that it just becomes easier for us. Once you're overwhelmed, those are classic states to easily begin to influence the behavior of others. If you're uncertain, if you're afraid, if you want to control large groups of people, get them to be in a state of fear. Yeah,
absolutely.
Get them to be uncertain. Right. Come up with messaging that is so simple and seemingly logical that nobody could debate it. Red meat is bad. Animal fat is bad. Animal foods are bad. Plant-based foods are good. Okay, that's right. Pretty.
Just eat plants.
Just eat plants.
And everything will be okay.
And and there's certainly a lot of epidemiology that would suggest that plant-based foods and cultures that consume them often have good health sort of metrics epidemiologically. But I think we would make the case between some plant-based foods are more concerning than others, right? It's this all or nothing. It's this sort of lumping. And a lot of this review, again, brings me back to this sort of paleo context, John, where grains, legumes, things that from a paleo context would raise concern with respect to biologic compatibility seems to have a bit more traction when you look at how many of those Neolithic agricultural foods are processed and grown. And so that not only are these foods that one might make the case don't have great human biologic compatibility, even when they're of good quality, if you will, in the modern agricultural systems that we live in, it just adds more fuel to the fire. So I do think buyer beware is an important aspect for anyone looking at the public health messaging. And I, as you might put it, John, to some extent, I think we are being duped. And yeah. I look at the plant-based mantra much the same way that I've looked at other, red meat is bad mantra, eggs are bad mantra, whole fat dairy is bad mantra, sunlight is bad mantra, vegetable oils are good mantra, anything from a plant is good mantra. And all of these sort of hot cultural trends always end up being met with, I think, just either bad research or interpretations and guidance that is just heavily biased. And if you're convinced that meat is bad and any animal food source is bad and you worship plants, And you know, we love plants and plant-based, you know, but there, you know, it, there's a, almost a religious, you know, I don't want to be too controversial here, but there is a tendency to cling with a belief and a confidence that you are being served as best as you can be served, which couldn't be further from the truth. And there's also that tendency, I think people do need to just be more mindful of how easy it is to be manipulated by the marketing that's out there. And there are just so many examples of that.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. What, you yeah. know, it, and so I, it, it's just another sort of landmine out there that people need to be mindful of as they navigate and how they choose to deal with that. In my own life, John, I certainly tend to minimize grain consumption. We've talked a lot about coffee and coffee grown at high altitudes and, you know, not cooked to, you know, high, high temperatures and other aspects of healthy lifestyle in general, where you're trying to create an activation of all of those resiliency rejuvenating systems that are disrupted by these pervasive environmental toxins. And so the more active we are, and right, and the more sunlight and circadian entrainment we have, the more we question the consensus messaging and really pay attention to how we feel after eating a particular food. I just think that level of vigilance and lifestyle has to be taken to another level, because the environments within which we wish to live long and live well are no longer designed to promote that that outcome. So the more we can take matters into our own hands, the better.
That's beautiful, Mark. It's really well said. There are a lot of these landmines, right? You got to, you know, to make your way as safely as possible from point A to point B, you have to really pay attention. You have to try to, you know, see between the blades of grass for the mines. And I think it's difficult for people to, you know, kind of put all of this in some sense, some sort of order and make sense of it all. I am empathetic for a lot of people that say, well, what about this or what about that? Because to your point, it's now been, you know, there, it's been put out there in a way that it's very confusing and there is so much fear. But I want to leave our listeners with this, like, you know, the amazing thing, you touched on this earlier, is that these incredible systems we have that are going to be responsible for our resiliency, you can get them back on their feet. But you gotta really cut off the exposure, right? So you gotta maybe do your own homework. It's not that you're necessarily gonna believe, you know, everything that you and I are saying. And that's not only understandable, but I always recommend it. Do your own homework. You know, look into these things. Look at the papers that you do such an amazing job of providing our listeners. You know, look at the papers, do your own homework. And then if you eliminate your exposure to some of these things, and it might not be mycotoxins, it might be omega-6s, right? Or it might be something else we've talked about. When you eliminate your exposure and then you set your body up for a more effective elimination pathway, and in the case of mycotoxins, you really want to lose your bile. You want to do everything you can, right, to facilitate bile leaving the body. Mm-hmm. And it's really simple ways to do that. Eating beets, maybe using something like pectin, modified citrus pectin. There are a lot of different things you can do to bind bile so that it doesn't get recycled from the large intestine and end up going back to the liver. But, you know, find the pathways that will really facilitate kind of this detoxification that's necessary, that we all need. Because, you know, what you said earlier is that exposure is going to be basically, it's axiomatic. You're going to have exposure, right? Because of the world we live in. But the incredible thing about the human body is that it's just so resilient, and it has ways of eliminating a large percentage of the burden that we're under. But you got to do everything you can to support it. And I hope our listeners feel empowered after these discussions, and that it's not.
Yeah, thank you for that, John. And I think it's so important that people not come away from information like this feeling too overwhelmed, too fearful. That's the last thing we wish to inspire. You know, we live in environments where, you know, this is where we're at as a human species. So it's easy to get overwhelmed. And so just, you know, take that pulse. And if it's, it is what it is. It's good to just be aware of it and then to begin to be more thoughtful in how you're choosing. And some days our choices will be better than others. But the more we interpret and respond with a greater level of fear, the more we set ourselves up for a future that will pose us with even more challenges. And so I do think it's important to, each day, right? You've got to find joy and express that. And there's a lot we could be consumed by out there. And this is just yet another addition 100%. To a list of things to why get up today? You know, but that's certainly not how we want people to be thinking about this. Right. Always a pleasure, John.
Same here, buddy.
Appreciate the depth and I think the extent to which translating this information, I got feedback recently from one of our listeners who commented on how she appreciated that what we suggest in terms of actionable steps is relatively easy. This does not have to be complicated. We're not suggesting people get complex detox programs and enemas and, you know, this, there are plenty of ways you can go to, you know, try to, fight this, but for the most part, navigating life should have more ease than effort. As you always point out, John, it has to be sort of incremental and so the more empowered we are with information, at least the more wisely we can choose. And the less dependent we are on the authorities for that information, the better. As a physician, I hate to say that, but that's just where we're at. There are too many influences, even with well-intentioned people and leaders, that ultimately what's best for you, it has to be decided from your experiences. Trust nothing at face value, as we like to say, right, John?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you all for listening to the Health Edge. I will get all of the references that we alluded to here in the slide deck on our website, healthedgepodcast.com. If this information is of value, please share it with those you love. And we look forward to seeing everyone again in the near future.
Thanks, Mark. Take care, buddy.
You as well, John. Peace, brother.